Hi, everybody. This is Kate Manchester. I'm the publisher of Edible Santa Fe and member of Edible Communities. And you're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. And we'd like to thank our sponsor today, Hearst Ranch, for making our show possible. Edible Communities creates editorially rich community-based local foods publications in distinct culinary regions throughout the U.S. and Canada. And I believe we're about 55 or 58 publications right now. And our mission is to connect consumers with family farmers, growers, chefs, and food artisans of all kinds. And we believe that every person has the right to affordable, fresh, healthful food on a daily basis. We are for-profit, member-driven corp, and we are individuals who each own our publications. We are local food advocates and residents of the communities we publish in. And it's a business model that not only supports our values, but also preserves the integrity of our member publications and the communities we serve. And we've got a terrific, terrific show for you today. We're going to be talking to two really interesting people. The first is Steve Warshauer, and Steve has lived and worked in New Mexico as a farmer since 1976, and for the last 33 years, he's worked in agricultural product development and marketing. He has a farm called Beneficial Farm. He uses the latest techniques for soil and water conservation, green energy production, direct marketing. He actually has, his farm is biodynamic, I believe. He also founded a collaborative and pooled marketing and distribution system for premium eggs and vegetables under the name of Beneficial Farms. And he's recently, in the last 2 years, he was trained in enterprise facilitation. And he currently manages the Enterprise Development Office of La Montanilla Co-op and their food shed project, or their distribution center. Steve has served on the boards of directors for several New Mexico organizations devoted to land preservation and working land issues. And he works tirelessly here in New Mexico with farmers and ranchers around the Southwest to build value chains and address issues and barriers to the increased production and consumption of foods produced in our region. And today, Steve is one of the most articulate people I know on the subject of H.R. 875 and H.R. 2749, otherwise known as the Food Safety Enhancement Act. And people were up in arms over H.R. 875, but after talking to Steve, I realized that H.R. 2749, which is this bill known as the Food Safety Enhancement Act, is actually the one that we really need to pay attention to and make our voices heard. And apparently we've got some time in the next year or so, maybe even longer. So we're going to talk to Steve about all of that today. And then later in the show, we'll be talking with Josh Vertel. And Josh is the new executive director for Slow Food USA. And he's only 31, maybe 32 years old, former farmer, and former founder of the, what is it, the Yale Food Shed. What was that? What was the name of it? Yale Sustainable Food Project. There we are. Anyway, so we've got a terrific show, so hang in, and we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Steve Warshauer. Thank you. This is Kate Manchester. We're back with the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. Today our sponsor is Hearst Ranch. And we're back talking with Steve Warshower. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Kate. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. So I gave everybody a little primer, and we talked about your, what you do here in New Mexico. And I basically have been looking at H.R. 875. And then I realized after talking to you that it's not H.R. 875 that we need to worry about. It's actually H.R., is it 2749?
I think it's 2647.
2647, okay.
That 2647 is coming out of the Energy and Commerce Committee, which is overseen by Representative Waxman of California.
Okay, so can you give us a really, really, in a nutshell, I know this is hard, but 875 deals with food safety, and now this new bill is actually, you tell us. Because
well, what was really important about 875, besides the very vague wording that left many people afraid of its intentions, what was important about its actual intentions was Representative DeLauro's desire to see U.S. food safety practices at the federal level unified under a single agency. That was the key, unique attribute of 875. Along with that, she undertook to reform, if you will, the food safety practices by being more specific about how processors in particular, food processors and food distributors and food handlers in particular, would be regulated. That aspect, you know, the regulation of food processors and food handlers is normally, or currently, it's the venue of FDA. And so what 2647 does is it attempts to modernize FDA's regulatory authority and to make very much more specific the conditions in which FDA operates, and to give it more power to operate and to give it more resources to operate. And that's what 2647 does. It is somewhat, one could call it the FDA Modernization Act, but it's also called the Food Safety Modernization Act.
And what does this mean? What does it mean for a small producer? For example, I was talking to Tom Delahanty of Pollo Real the other day, and he said basically it's pretty much, for a small producer like him, it's a different set of rules for large producers versus small producers. In other words, he told me, and you can correct me or step in any time, but he told me that, a big poultry producer, for example, that they actually can't go in there and make the same demands as they do on a small producer.
I don't agree with that statement at all.
Okay.
First of all, the regulation of livestock operations is currently part of USDA, and
okay.
One of the things that the Waxman bill does is it validates that mandate. It explicitly says that FDA authority will not supersede USDA authority where it exists. Now, when it comes to USDA inspection, larger plants have a live-in inspector. Okay? They pay for an office and an inspector to live on their premises. I don't know how much more invasive it could be than that.
Wow.
Now, what happens with smaller plants is that they schedule the inspector's arrival at key times, and the inspector has to be present to be USDA inspected. But there also, within the USDA Food Safety Inspection Service, there is also a category of exemption for smaller producers, which Tom Delahanty would fit into if he was willing to comply with it.
Okay. And the category, so how does that work, actually? So how does this category of exemption work?
Well, I haven't studied that one in great detail. I've worked with a couple of other plants who are seeking exempt status under USDA, and none of them find it particularly offensive.
Okay. So what is the danger and of this 2647? What is the danger, and what's the we know that there's going to be fallout. And
well, I think there's a couple levels of reaction. that occur whenever the government intervenes. The first thing we do is we question its motives. And in this case, the stated motives are to protect the public against unsafe food. Are there other motives? For example, does the government have an agenda against small-scale agriculture? That would be something that we would look to read between the lines, and that's something which every bit of research I've done and every bit of conversation I've had with Washington, D.C. staffers of some of these legislators, as well as with other sustainable ag people around the country, is that absolutely not. There is no existing agenda to harm small and medium-scale agriculture. What there may be is unintended fallout from their attempts to better regulate larger-scale agriculture. Mm-hmm. And so most of the work that we do now in the sustainable ag community, who has been very active in attempting to impact this current 2647 bill, is basically to bring to the attention of these staffers the unintended consequences of different language that's part of their attempt to improve regulatory processes around the larger-scale food system. And even at that, what we're watching out for is the fact that the lawmakers write the law, but they don't write the regulations. Regulators write regulations. So there's kind of a multi-step process here. The lawmakers write a law, and that law reflects their intent. That, upon passing that law, the regulations that implement the law are written in a public process through the Federal Register and open public hearings. And that regulatory rulemaking process is very, very comprehensive and complex. So, for example, that's how come in the National Organic Program, when the initial rulemaking came out that allowed municipal sludge and genetically engineered seeds in organic, the organic community rose up and said, heck no, this isn't what we want, and they went back and corrected the rule. So rulemaking is the actual implementation of the law, and there's every reason to expect that we will have enormous impact as public body into the rulemaking process. Then the very final step is that those rules get into the hands of regulators, and in almost every case, there's some room for interpretation. There are probably such thing as good regulators, and there are definitely such thing as bad regulators. So we have three different steps in which we have to be vigilant, and we have to take an appropriate opportunity to engage the process. Step one is the lawmaking process, which is going on now. Mm-hmm. Step two is the rulemaking process, which will follow, and then if the law is passed. And then step three is the implementation process, when we have to deal with individual regulators.
And, okay, so ultimately...
I hear you sigh, Kate. Is that more than you wanted to hear?
No, it's actually not more than that, because I'm still... And I'm actually looking online. I think it might be Bill... I think it's a different... I think we're talking about... Because Bill 2647 has to do with the military.
Oh, gosh. Then you were right, 2749.
So I think it's H.R. 2749, which is called the... what is it called? Where are my notes here? 2749 is called, bear with me for just a second, Food Safety Enhancement Act?
That's the one. My bad.
Okay, so that's Bill 2749. It's the Food Safety Enhancement Act. Okay, so in lay terms, because I know this is pretty complicated, in lay terms, what the point is to give, tell us what the point is, since you're much more articulate about this than I am.
Well, the problem, okay, FDA, which has the authority over 96% of the food moving around the U.S., was basically gutted during the 8 years under George Bush. They were so underfunded that they had less money to do their job than USDA did for livestock. And so the result was that all of these essentially... the industry was left to self-regulate, which we saw how well that worked. And
right.
So the intent of this bill is to give FDA the authority and the resources it needs to better assure the safety of our food system. That's the whole goal. The question is, will the pursuit of that goal unintentionally affect small and regional agriculture systems in adverse ways? So that's what we're on the lookout for. And a good example of that would be in this 2749, I'll give the correct number now. I apologize for that. In 2749, a system of user fees is being implemented which if it were to go into effect as currently proposed, would raise $189 million a year for FDA for its enforcement practices. But the problem with a user fee as an approach is that it kind of creates a disincentive to the regulator, because now you are the user becomes your customer rather than your objective subject. So under this, and if a user fee is a one size fits all fee, it's obviously harder for you to afford the smaller your operation is.
Right.
So within the sustainable ag response to this Waxman bill, the first thing that was requested was a sliding scale, and also we'll call it a basement, a level below which, if your operation is that small, there's no fee. Well, that idea was not accepted. Instead, what was accepted was lowering the proposed fee from $1,000 to $500, which still doesn't help you if you're a small operator.
And I think that's the thing that people don't really understand. I mean, $500 to a farmer in New Mexico whose average salary, I think the average salary, and Steve, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is $10,000 a year.
Well, I don't know the actual figure, but one thing I do know for sure is that the fastest growing segment of the USDA Ag Census is in farms under $25,000 a year of growth.
So $500 is a lot of money. And this is, I mean, it's not just once, it's several times that they've got to pay this, from what I understand.
Well, I think that fee is an annual fee.
The other thing
to consider, the other issue that we're trying to, I would say, clarify in the lawmaking process around this bill is, who actually does this bill cover? What authority is FDA seeking over farms? And so far, the answer appears to be very little. The FDA only wants to be able to go into farms if they are traced back to be the source of food that's eventually processed and problematic. So we're not seeing USDA want to come inspect farms and to develop, we're not seeing FDA being granted the authority to regulate farms.
Okay.
What we're seeing is strictly relating to processors. But what you said about the $500 fee and its impact on small processors is just as true as it would be on small farmers. If you're producing $5,000 to $10,000 a year of jam or salsa or something, $500 is a lot of money.
Right. So I think that's an important point, too.
One of the great fears about 875 was people thought that Representative DeLauro was trying to put regulators on our farms and in our backyard gardens and so on. That's a really impractical idea, and it's also one that was never part of their intent, I don't believe. Though the way their language was worded, it was vague enough that one could read that into the language. And if one didn't realize that the language doesn't create the regulation, the language simply forms the intent, then one could definitely worry about what their intention was.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's an annual fee. The $500 is an annual fee for a small producer. Is that whether or not there's an outbreak traced to you?
No,
the
food processing rules would make it necessary for all processors to register with FDA, and that registration would be, as currently proposed, that registration would be based on that $500 fee. So there's a lot of discussion ongoing about is there a basement level of processing that from which processors should be exempt from that fee and exempt from FDA inspection and regulation. And that's going to be worked out, I suspect, between the House bill, if it's passed, and whatever gets passed in the Senate.
Okay, now, what do you think about this personally? Because I think that a lot of, first of all, small producers, and again, you know, even if we were just to take New Mexico as an example, it doesn't feel that the outbreaks are coming from these small producers. In fact, most of the outbreaks that we've had in recent years has come from large producers.
Well, I think everybody that looks at the situation objectively would agree that the scariest outbreaks are occurring from the largest plants and processors and operations with the greatest distance reach in distribution, because those are the situations where it's a long time till they can figure out what happened, and a lot of people are affected while that goes on. the value, the inherent advantage of local and smaller scale and regional production and distribution is that our traceability chains are very short. To the statement that we're not making anybody sick, I'm not so sure.
Okay.
The fact is, if we are making people sick, it's in individual isolated occurrences which don't become sufficiently identified as trends to warrant any response. And one thing that's very important to FDA right now is that they put their resources in the areas of greatest risk. So small-scale, local, and regional processes will not be deemed areas of great risk because our impact is too small. But to use that as an argument that we shouldn't be included in the process at all, I think is actually self-defeating. The only real rationale to say we don't need to be part of the food safety system at all would be to say, not so much that we're not making anybody sick, but it would be to say we're not big enough impact to bother. And we want to be bigger in impact.
Mm-hmm.
We want our local and regional food supplies to become more and more important in our communities.
Right.
Our advantage is on the traceback side. We have a very easy time knowing which of our products went to whom and how they got there, and we have a very easy time doing a rudimentary type of accounting and reporting system. So for myself, I can say with some perhaps embarrassment that all of this attention has certainly caused me to improve my food safety practices at my own farm. And in that sense, I'm grateful for that attention because I did find some areas for improvement that were pretty accessible. But ultimately, most of the food safety, on-farm food safety requirements are very common sense. If people aren't doing them, they could be doing them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that over time, training from our co-op extensions, from our Department of Ag, from the various service providers that we rely on to help us, you know, build our businesses, the training that we can get is going to help us all to be better farmers, and I don't think that we have a reason or a right to say we don't need to be trained. I think we all need to check our food safety practices and make sure that we're doing them well.
I agree with that. I mean, it's kind of a hard argument to, it's a hard, you know, to hear you talk about it in this way, it seems to make sense. Yes, there will be some fallout, and, you know, there will certainly be people that don't want to comply. But, you know, if you sit down and actually read this, and basically it sounds to me like we are still in the process, or the government is still in the process of forming, you know, this bill is not, it's not set in stone yet.
Well, when the bill passes and becomes law, whatever it says is the law of the land at that time. However, fact of the matter is we've spent, you know, so many years creating a broken food safety system. I mean, let's not even go to the question of, you know, home-based processing, which is illegal in New Mexico, although there are 20 states that have home-based processing rules for direct marketers. There's as much impact on our local and regional food systems from the state of New Mexico Health Department and Environment Department and from local county health officials as there is from the federal level. The food safety issue is not going to go away. We're going to be learning about it, we're going to be dealing with it, and we're going to be hopefully improving in every possible way the science about it as well for several years to come because we've spent so long avoiding it. And the avoidance was a product, I think, of the anti-regulatory methods of the previous administration, which came along at a very important time and really undermined our ability to improve the quality of the food system from a food safety perspective.
Steve, what can people do if they want to be part of this conversation? What can they do?
Boy, I think that from the consumer standpoint, some of the best information around right now is coming from Food and Water Watch.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good information source, and I think they may even send out action alerts from time to time.
They do.
I
that's
saw
food
some
and
action alerts
watch.
Last week from Consumers Union, and I didn't really like them that well. They were a little too inflammatory, and they weren't taking into account the reality of the process. You know, they were basically saying that this FDA, the current FDA bill, is written by big business to minimize its responsibility for food safety.
Mm.
And in actual fact, I don't think there's any stakeholders that are happy with this bill. Everyone feels it's getting at them at some level or another, and that might be an indication that it's fairly close to on target.
Interesting.
So, well, so I'm going to recommend Food and Water Watch as an information source. There's another national group called the National Organic Coalition, which I think is doing a good job of tracking food safety issues and the food safety discussion and its impact on the organic community. And at this point, I'm not aware of any information clearinghouse in New Mexico or any efforts to take this ongoing discussion and direct thinking specifically towards our New Mexico farmers and agricultural mm-hmm. communities. I'm not aware of such a thing going on.
Well, if people want to read the bill, you can go to www.govtrack, that's G-O-V as in Victor, track, T-R-A-C-K, .us/Congress/bill. And it's, again, it's H.R. 2749. It's called the Food Safety Enhancement Act of 2009. And I would say that Food and Water Watch or foodandwater.org is probably a good place to get some good information. Steve, I'd like to thank you for being with us today and helping us break it down. And
well, one thought to say in closing is I bet most of us have heard the saying, if something seems too good to be true, beware, it probably is.
Right.
The converse is, if something seems too bad to be true, it probably isn't. So when it comes to our worst possible fears of the government taking over our backyards and preventing us from eating our own carrots and this sort of thing, hopefully for most of us, that's clearly too bad to be true, and I don't think that's where this is going. But I do think that the next several years, it's going to be a lively discussion about how to create and minimize the impact of a food safety system that has gotten fairly poor in its performance and has put a lot of people at risk. And our lawmakers are involved because the public doesn't want that. And whether the public reaction is emotional and irrational or whether it's factual, once there's enough of it and it gets to Washington, D.C., then action happens. So our job is to be on the lookout for unintended consequences and try to help the process move forward.
And I think that, again, education is the key. So, again, if you don't go to GovTrack, try opencongress.org. And you can read a synopsis, or you can read the whole bill, and you can read, I encourage people to really get out there and educate yourselves and become part of this conversation. Write letters, call your congressman, call your representatives, and make your voice heard. I think we have an opportunity here to make some positive change.
And I think what we want is regulation, fees, and appropriate penalties for larger producers whose distance reaches far and as a result may be impacting larger numbers of people. And we want training. We want support for our local and regional agricultural community to help us improve our food safety practices and any other practices that we're involved in that might be subject to better practices than we're currently aware of.
All good things. Steve, thank you very, very much.
You're welcome, Kate.
Thanks so much. We are going to take a short break, and we're going to come back with Josh Viertel from Slow Food USA, and we're going to talk about where slow food's going.
Oh, give me land, lots of land, and the starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you again. Don't fence me in. Just turn me loose. Let me straddle my own saddle underneath the western skies. On my guise, let me wander over yonder till I see the mountains rise. I want to ride to the ridge where the west commences. Gaze at the moon until I lose my senses. I can't look at hobbles and I can't stand fences. Don't fence.
is Kate Manchester. You're listening to the Edible Community Show here on Heritage Radio Network. And we are being sponsored today by Hearst Ranch. So we'd like to give a big shout out to Hearst Ranch and say thank you for that. And we are back to talk with Josh Viertel of Slow Food USA. And for those of you that don't know what Slow Food is, it was a movement that was actually begun in the late 80s by a guy named Carlo Petrini. And basically this was Carlo Petrini's reaction to the first McDonald's, I believe, growing up in Rome. And he started a whole movement around slow food. And Slow Food believes that everyone has a fundamental right to pleasure and the responsibility to protect the heritage of food, tradition, and culture that make this pleasure possible. The movement founded upon a concept of eco-gastronomy and a recognition of the strong connections between plate and planet. And Josh Viertel has made many contributions to the sustainable food movement in the past as a teacher, farmer, activist. He was co-founder and co-director of the Yale Sustainable Food Project, and he is now the executive director for Slow Food USA. And just so you know, Slow Food has more than 50,000 members and supporters in this nation alone, and across the world, we've got more than 85,000 members in 130 countries. So this is a real movement. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm so thrilled to have you here. I've been following you for a long time, and I actually met you in Mexico, or I'm not sure if we actually met, but we were part of a group around the International Congress, Slow Food International Congress, and I was deeply, deeply moved and inspired by the youth attending, and most of whom were students at the University of Gastronomy, or Slow Food U, I guess, in Bra, Italy, and I was really encouraged to see all of the youth involvement and to hear the things that they had to say. And I understand that you actually had something to do with that.
Yeah, it was really important to me going down to that meeting in Puebla that the leaders of Slow Food from all over the world get to see just how incredible the energy and creativity and also the lack of willingness to compromise, the real committed young people who were part of this movement. I really wanted that to be a part of that meeting. At that point, I was just on the board for Slow Food USA, so I began talking with Slow Food International and with the staff of Slow Food USA about whether we could get a delegation of youth from around the world, one strong delegation from the U.S., and then another delegation from the University of Gastronomic Sciences to come down. And it was great to have them there, and it actually led to an international commitment that young people really be a part of Slow Food's work internationally.
Now, just to give people, it's a little bit confusing even for those of us who are part of Slow Food, but Slow Food International and Slow Food USA, each country has their own Slow Food organization. Is that true?
Essentially. I mean, really, for people who aren't inside the organization, what matters is that Slow Food is working to make a good, clean, fair food system all over the world, and there are countries that have a really strong presence and countries that just have a few members. The U.S. has a really, really strong presence and a strong national office, and the international organization basically takes care of all of the countries that don't have national offices, and each of the countries that do essentially help to run Slow Food International. So Slow Food USA has a pretty strong voice in helping to shape what Slow Food International does.
How did you wind up as president of Slow Food USA?
That's a great question. I was fairly active and involved in the sustainable food movement while I was working at Yale. There I was working to transition their food services over to be local and sustainable, and I was starting a small farm for students and building programs for undergraduates around food and agriculture. And I saw Slow Food in this country as something that had a huge potential to basically advocate for big structural changes in the food system that would make it easier for our work to happen. You know, we've got members all over the U.S. who really care about these issues and who are doing this work in their everyday way, but we've never seen an organization or a movement in this country around sustainability, food, and agriculture that could actually push for big legislative changes or push for big structural changes. And I thought, what a magical thing that you could have an organization that could both do that local change on the ground, like some of our chapters are doing preservation of heritage breeds that are really regional or part of their place. Some of them are getting public schools to have gardens in them in their local place. But then we could also speak with the national voice on key issues. For me, that was a really compelling opportunity. And so I just got more involved in the organization. At a certain point, I was asked to join the board. And as I was pushing for some of these changes, a position was created, and I stepped off of the board and applied for it. And months later and many interviews later, was really thrilled to be selected.
Surprise, it's you. That's great. I honestly, I can't think of a better person because, you know, given your background and given your passion, plus you've also been a farmer.
I was, and I learned it was not easy work, but it was the most satisfying work in the world, and I miss that a lot right now.
Yeah. So why did you want to do, you know, more work with slow food instead of, I don't know, you know, you seem to be doing great stuff at Yale, and I'm sure there are 8 million directions you could have gone. I mean, there's Roots of Change in California. So why slow food?
Well, what's so magical about slow food is that it is completely local. Mm-hmm. But it's also completely national, and it's also completely international. So it's a global movement that's not a big, indifferent international non-government organization, or a big nonprofit. It's a really personal organization that does really important work locally. That's very concrete, and it's founded on personal relationships. But it also has the potential to really to speak nationally, to speak internationally, and to essentially sort participants in a movement by values. So we have some values about the food we eat and the way it's produced, and we can organize around those values and actually have huge numbers of people working together to make the kind of food system we want. And I see no other organization that has the potential to play that role, to really serve the changes in the food system we want to make in that way.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about slow food on campus. I don't really know much about it. Mm. And I'm really intrigued, and I think it's, again, it's so promising when you see young people. I sound like my parents now. I'm not that old, but when you really see, you know, 19, 20-year-old kids that are really passionate and committed about, you know, that have strong values and strong commitment to local food. Tell us a little bit about what's happening and about slow food on campus.
Well, college students are completely uncompromising and really are driven by a desire to have a better world. And they are getting more and more involved in the sustainable food movement, really with or without slow food. They're pushing their college administrators to get local and organic food. They are pushing to create small farms on campus. They're graduating and going on and getting internships or even starting their own farms. So they're a part of this, what I think of as really broader social movement. And I think they're driving it. And so slow food on campus is basically a way that people with that energy and with that drive who are in college can get involved in the broader movement and in the organization. And so college students are creating basically local chapters on their campuses and are pushing to change the food system where they are. At UNC, at Chapel Hill, they were pushing their dining services to get local food, and they said, oh, we have local pork, and it turned out it was from the Smithfield plant, which, of course, is not that far away, and they said, well, that's not good enough. And so they partnered with the local slow food chapter and said, hey, we want to work together to raise awareness about this issue, and that developed them, the college students, into their own chapter, and they had a great whole hog barbecue with heritage pork and a local farmer, and had workers testify about what their experience was like from working at the Smithfield plant. So people could really see both a good, clean, fair food system and a less fair, less good, less clean one together, and that was college students driving local slow food activity. So we're seeing that happen all over the country, and we really just want to tap into it and make as much room as possible for young people to drive what we do.
I have lots of conversations with Woody Tash of Slow Money.
Yeah,
and
Woody's great.
One of the things, you know, part of one of the groups that I'm involved with here in New Mexico, I'm involved with an organization that's an offshoot of the Bali organization, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies and the Santa Fe Business Alliance. And we've been doing this whole food and fuels project and going, you know, all over the state talking to communities about what their needs are. And And the one thing that we hear over and over and over again, Josh, is that you've got most of the farmers here in New Mexico are, you know, 50s, 60s, or 70s, and there's nobody to take over the family farm, number one. Number two, young farmers that are coming here can't afford farmland. And I understand that this is, you know, this is an issue, you know, from East Coast to West Coast and everywhere in between, that, you know, land is expensive. And so how do you talk to these kids about the reality that here we are in this movement and we want to make major changes in our food system and our food supply, and we want to make major changes, but there's kind of this disconnect between, you know, the reality of what a young kid can make as a farmer and whether or not they can afford farmland. How do you address that?
Well, it's a really hard situation. I think a few things have to happen. One is we have to acknowledge that in the interim, before we really fix every problem linked to this challenge, that there are some pretty cool opportunities for halfway measures to do good work. So young people are linking up with urban and suburban landowners to grow food on land that they don't own and become part of the local economy in that way. Now, that's flawed for those people who are farming over time because they are investing in that piece of land by increasing the soil organic matter, by building outbuildings, by really putting systems in place to make it productive. But they don't own those investments. So ultimately, that's not a just solution for them, but it's a good thing to do in the meantime. I think that we need to do really good work around buying development rights for land and then passing that land in a way that implies some ownership to young people to farm. There are actually some really good federal programs to get low or no interest loans for beginning farmers. They're not very well publicized, and one thing we want to start doing is helping young people to find those resources. And then I think the kind of work that Woody's doing around local economies is really important to help that out as well. The one thing that really I come back to as a challenge that is important to acknowledge is that it's not enough to just be a wealthy landowner who lets a young person farm on your farm,
right?
Because that young person's investing their life and they're not accumulating any capital. So ultimately, that's not a model that will drive young people to become farmers. So we have to find other models for how to do that.
I just think this is so timely, and I think that we also need to mention what the Slow Food Mission is, because I'm looking at it. It says, Slow Food USA seeks to create dramatic and lasting change in the food system. We reconnect Americans with the people, traditions, plants, animals, fertile soils, and waters that produce our food. We work to inspire a transformation in food policy, production practices, and market forces so that they ensure quality, sustainability, and pleasure in the food we eat. So that very much ties in with you know, where you're headed as an organization. I think one of my questions for you was, you know, where do you see Slow Food USA? Like, where do you want to take this in the next 5 years?
Well, I think one thing that's really important that we're just rolling up our sleeves to get into is to begin doing advocacy around big structural issues in our food system. So it's no longer enough just to change your food system locally, just to get a local farmer's market started, just to get a garden in your public school. It's really important work. It's maybe the most important work in the world, but we also need to retain a little bit of our energy to do advocacy around creating bigger structural changes. So I want to see Slow Food become an organization that can both work to create a farm bill that makes it possible for good, clean, and fair food for everyone to have access to good, clean, and fair food, and to create local projects on the ground that actually make that happen, to do really great projects, bringing gardens into public schools and getting local organic food in the dining services there, but then also doing advocacy nationally so that the Child Nutrition Act has room in it for schools to do that. So we're not doing local work and bumping up against national structural challenges or structural barriers. So tomorrow we're actually launching a campaign called Time for Lunch, which is going to be really focused all on the reauthorization of the Child Nutrition Act, and is going to be pushing Congress to reauthorize an act that has adequate funding so that schools can buy real food for their kids and serve real food to their kids, that gives authority to have oversight USDA oversight over dietary guidelines for vending machines and fast food that's sold in schools. Right now, they're just completely slipping under the radar. And it's also pushing for mandatory funding for farm-to-school projects, for grants to start local gardens in public schools as well. So we're just gearing up to launch this big campaign. It's going to be really exciting, and I think it'll change the bill, but also get Slow Food to a place where it can really advocate nationally around bigger issues as they come up.
Do you know what the bill is?
What the bill is? It's the Child Nutrition Act?
Child Nutrition Act, thank you.
Yes, and it needs to be reauthorized by the end of September.
Child Nutrition Act. Since we were just talking about, we were just talking with Steve Warshaw about H.R. 2749.
Oh, yeah.
And what that means. And you know, I kind of wanted to ask you if you would go over some of these, some of your other domestic programs. For example, the Arc of Taste. I get these questions all the time, but it would be great to hear it from Josh Gertel. Like, what is the U.S. Arc of Taste?
Great. So the Arc of Taste is basically a way in which we identify foods that are important culturally, that are linked to place, that are biodiverse, and that are maybe at risk, that are not a part of the mainstream marketplace, but are an important part of the heritage of that place, the biological and cultural heritage of that place. And so there's a committee that helps to identify and nominate these products, but really mostly it's done via our chapters. Mm-hmm. So our local chapters, local Slow Food members, they'll have a product, an animal, a vegetable variety that really matters, that's important to their place, that whose production maybe is waning, and they will do work basically to preserve it, to get it known, and to get it boarded on the ARC. And in the end, that often helps market that product. So if you look at like the Churro sheep in the Southwest, maybe some of your listeners have heard of that. You're in Santa Fe, right?
Right, so, right.
The Churro sheep is this phenomenal variety of sheep that was at risk, and now chapters are really working to help support growers who are growing it. The growers are leading the way with the genetics and with the cultural practices of raising that animal, and then the chapter and members are helping to make connections with chefs to understand why it's a phenomenal breed, and so that's ultimately going to increase biodiversity in the food system. That's the idea behind that program area.
It's also, I mean, something, and I'm glad you mentioned the Churro sheep, because the Churro sheep was part of the Navajo tradition for a long time. It was part of their culture, and it was an animal that they used. It produces apparently amazing wool and good meat, and it's also really well-suited to the Southwest. And
absolutely.
So, you know, this is also, you know, part of what Slow Food does is through food is to help not lose culture and practices around certain foods and traditions and things like that.
So. And First Nations so often have had a history in this place of developing the overlay between culture and nature in a way that really fits place. And there's so much value there. Both for those communities and for those outside of those communities who haven't ever benefited from that kind of deep knowledge, that often they're leading the way with those activities. I think also of like the white earth, phenomenal wild rice varieties. There's an incredible tradition that we really risk losing around local. Locally adapted biodiverse food.
Mm-hmm. Now we're. I got to move quickly here, but what is the difference between Presidia and Arc of Taste? I mean, I'm thinking that the Arc of Taste is the catalog, but the Presidia is actually the thing that maybe drives these foods to the catalog.
So the Presidia, in the end, is essentially a way to help market the foods, and it's an idea that really began in Italy. And the idea is once you've identified a food that is particular to a place and really has cultural value, then we can start engaging in activities to really support its production and really help market it. So the Presidia drives it into the marketplace once it's linked to, once it's considered a Presidia product.
Okay. And then there's RAFT, Renewing America's Food Traditions. Tell us about RAFT.
So Renewing America's Food Traditions is an alliance of several organizations like Chefs Collaborative, American Livestock Breed Conservancy, Gary Nabhan, who's an incredible individual who's done great work pioneering biodiversity in the food system. And the organization works together to really play the strengths of each of the partners to increase biodiversity in the food system. And so for us, that's playing the strength of our national network and the fact that we have people all over the country who care about and know about a good, clean, fair food system. Together, we are working to increase knowledge about heritage apple varieties, pork. We work together on the heritage turkey projects. We're looking towards a project on heritage chickens. And it's a partnership that's really helped, I think, bring a lot of important foods into not the mainstream, but out of risk.
Mm-hmm. Slow Food Nation.
Yes.
I know Slow Food Nation took place in San Francisco, I guess it was, last September, a year ago, in 2008, and you had more than 60,000 people over Labor Day weekend.
85,000 people.
Great, great turnout. I heard wonderful things. I wasn't able to go. Are there plans for, is this going to be an every 2 year thing like Terra Madre? How's Slow Food Nation going to work?
It's a great question. We're actually still feeling that out. Slow Food Nation was a phenomenal success. What it made us realize, what it helped us to realize, is that there's energy to do great events like that all over the country.
Right.
So the only criticism we really got about Slow Food Nation was, why wasn't it in my town?
Oh.
And the next one be in my town. So what we're trying to do is figure out the best way to basically capitalize on that energy and let slow food leaders and other leaders, farmers, community leaders, really get invested in events that really speak to their place. We know that the next Slow Food Nation needs to be true to the place where it happens, and we know that we don't need to just repeat something in one place because we have such a diverse community that we're working with. As part of this campaign, we're looking towards a day of action on Labor Day.
Mm-hmm.
On Labor Day, we're going to have people in cities all across the country staging eat-ins, and an eat-in is like a part potluck, part protest, and they're going to be asking for real food in the public school system, and all getting together, and basically there's no cost of admission. You just bring food you believe in, prepare it, bring it to this place, share it with people you meet there, and sign on to this broader petition, and we're going to be telling that story of America coming together to share food and demand real food for kids. Telling that online and telling that through prose and through video and pictures, and it will basically be the narrative of America doing its own Slow Food Nation, totally grassroots, in their own place, and doing it in a way that will ideally drive legislative change so that kids can have a more good, more clean, more fair food system.
Hmm. I've interviewed Ann Cooper several times from Berkeley, and I guess she's still working for Shape and East Foundation, and she's done a lot of great, great work around feeding kids real food.
Anne is unbelievable, and she's actually moving to Boulder to do it in Boulder now.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, which is great.
She is fantastic.
An unstoppable force of energy and a total pleasure to work with.
Well, we've just got a few minutes left. I'd like to talk about the U.S. Terra Madre Network.
Great.
And again, you know, if people haven't been involved in slow food or if they haven't been to a slow food, I would say the international events really, they have a striking quality about them. And it's, you know, again, I didn't go to Slow Food Nation here in the U.S., and I'm assuming that it probably had the same kind of energy and feeling, but any slow food event that I've been to outside of the States has been really phenomenal. And tell us a little bit about the U.S. Terra Madre Network.
Well, the Terra Madre Network, first, for those who don't know Terra Madre, it's an event in Turin every 2 years where we bring together farmers, fishermen, herders, basic food producers, also some chefs, students, musicians, people who are linked to food communities in their place. We bring them together in Turin from over 150 countries. And it is it's sort of like the international sustainable food movement meets Woodstock / the UN, all kind of mashed together. It's a really incredible, incredible event, very powerful, and particularly for people in places where they're the only ones in their community doing this work,
mm-hmm.
in very remote places, preserving their food traditions while everyone else is slipping towards the industrial food paradigm that the U.S. is exporting.
Right.
It's a very powerful emotional experience to realize that in 149 other countries, there are people in the same situation that they are, and that really they have a community. It's just a community that's global, even if their local community thinks they're nuts to try to preserve their traditions or to try to maintain food sovereignty. So it's a very powerful meeting. And there's an incredible group of delegates from the U.S. who've been to this meeting over the last three iterations. And they're all doing great work as farmers, as students, as fishermen. My first real encounter with slow food was at the first Terra Madre. And for me, it was an amazingly moving experience.
A life-changing event?
I'm sorry?
A life-changing event, maybe?
It was a life-changing event in many ways. You know, and then I was there as a farmer.
Right.
And to see these amazing people and these amazing conversations about management-intensive grazing on every single continent being discussed.
Right. I think that's one of the things that you come away from, you know, you come away with when you do some of these slow food events and you realize, oh my gosh, we're having the same conversation, you know, in China or France or Mozambique that we are in Santa Fe. I mean, we're all having the same conversations. We all have the same concerns, you know, and we all eat, and, you know, it's an incredibly unifying experience.
And it's a fantastic metaphor for community, because really community is built out of sharing food and sharing work.
That's right.
And what you realize is we might not, in person, share food very often, but at Terra Madre we share it in person. We actually eat together. And we might not realize that our work is shared, but ultimately, even if I make hay in January and you make hay in July, actually our work is shared, and that we're all working together to try to create a good, clean, fair food system. So we're sharing work and we're sharing food, and even if I'm raising millet in Ethiopia and you're doing it in Canada, we're actually very, very closely linked.
Yeah. Well, Josh, I really want to thank you for joining us this week. I know you're really super busy, and keep up the good work. I'm thrilled that you're at the helm, and I wish you all the best and success, and I'm really, really happy about the direction of slow food. It feels really good and right, and again, I'm thrilled that you're at the helm, and I'm looking forward to all the good things that you do, and we'd love to have you back again sometime.
Well, I would love to do it. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Josh.
Thanks so much, Kate.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
So this is Kate Manchester, and you have been listening to the Edible Communities Show here on Heritage Radio Network. Hearst Ranch is our sponsor today. They've made this show possible. And I invite you back next week. We're here every Monday from 5 to 6 on the East Coast. And next week, Marla Camp, who's the publisher of Edible Austin, will be your host for the Edible Communities radio show. So again, join us. If you've got any questions, you can reach me, Kate, at ediblesantafe.com. Reach out, any comments, questions. And again, please join us next week. If you miss us live, find us on the web at heritageradionetwork.com, Edible Communities.